From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi Tuesday dismissed as propaganda claims by Islamic State insurgents that they brought down a Russian jetliner that crashed in the Sinai Peninsula, killing all 224 people aboard. When there is propaganda that it crashed because of ISIS, there is one way to damage the stability and security of Egypt and the image of Egypt, according to Sisi speaking to the BBC. Believe me, the situation in Sinai, especially in this limited area, is under our full control. Meanwhile, investigators in Egypt began their examination of the flight recorders recovered from the wreckage of the Metro jet, and Russian families began the process of identifying the bodies. A court in India has ordered a life sentence for a man convicted of raping a passenger while driving for the mobile ride-sharing company Uber. This is the public prosecutor, Atul Srivastava.
Sentence I have argued that this is the expectation of the society. The maximum punishment should be given to the awarded to this man so that the good message to go to the society that we all are safe. And if we are going to commit anything wrong, then we will be handled like this.
The sentence for Shiv Kumar Yadav was a maximum he was eligible to receive after being convicted last month. The woman had hired Yadav to take her home after a dinner with friends last December, and she said he raped her after she fell asleep in the car. A rare cyclone slammed into southeastern Yemen, bringing with it strong winds, heavy flooding, and causing massive damage. Cyclone Chapala made landfall Tuesday in the Al-Qaeda-controlled town of Mukallala, packing winds of up to 130 kilometers an hour. So far, there have been no reports of injuries. You're listening to VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry expressed support for boosting Turkmenistan's economic prospects as he visited Tuesday on the final leg of a five-nation tour of Central Asia. He said that we can do more together to help your people develop some of the skill sets necessary in this modern economy. He made those comments as he met with Turkmenistan's president during his brief stop. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini met with the Arab League Secretary General Nabil El Arabi at the Arab League headquarters in Cairo Tuesday. She spoke at a news conference in the Egyptian capital.
We really hope and we really invite the Libyan relevant decision makers in these hours to take responsibility and respond to the need of their people at the call of the international and regional community, to take responsibility and unite forces before it is Daesh taking more ground in the country, and to give the Libyan people the right to live in peace and to live in a country that can be rebuilt.
Libya has been split between an Islamist-backed government based in Tripoli and an internationally recognized government in the country's east. A prosecutor Tuesday sought a murder conviction against Oscar Pistorius before South Africa's Supreme Court of Appeal, saying a lower court erred in acquitting the athlete of that charge for killing his girlfriend instead of convicting him of culpable homicide. Pistorius's chief defense lawyer, Barry Rue, also presented arguments to the judges.
But that's exactly the point that the submission I'm making, Justice Lees. I submit that you cannot, from that piece of the finding, cannot isolate the factual finding that he genuinely believed that he acted in danger.
If convicted, Pistorius would face a minimum sentence of 15 years in prison, as South Africa no longer has the death penalty. Iraqi politician Ahmed Chalabi, who helped push for the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, died Tuesday of a heart attack. Lawmakers and state television said Chalabi died in Baghdad, where the 71-year-old was serving as chairman of the parliament's finance committee. Chalabi spent most of his life in Britain and in the United States, where he earned a master's degree and a doctorate. A plane had to make an emergency landing because of a smoke indication in the cargo bay, but it wasn't due to a fire. It was due because of sheep. According to the Aviation Herald, a Singapore Airlines flight had to make an unscheduled stop when the cockpit noticed a smoke warning. The aircraft was transporting more than 2,000 sheep from Sydney to Kuala Lumpur. The plane landed safely and found nothing except it was a result of exhaust gases and manure produced by the sheep.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Thank you. Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an expert predicts a final report on the Russian plane crash in Egypt may take months. A respected researcher speaks with us about working with the deadly Ebola virus.
Training and trust are the two T's that I talk about when I talk about how we go forward working with these viruses.
We look at the suggestion that Russia might be testing steps to cut off the nation from internet. And hear that Justin Bieber is back with a new hit and new troubles. It's right here on The Voice of America. Russian aviation officials are analyzing the recovered flight recorders from the ill-fated Russian Metro jet that crashed in the Egyptian desert Saturday, killing all 224 people on board. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us now here in the studio. Welcome, Victor.
Hello, Susan. Todd Curtis is with the online publication AirSafe, which is devoted to airline safety and security information. He told me that it's too early to determine a cause, but expects the coming days to reveal vital information.
Absent the information from the recorders and other information from the wreckage itself, it's entirely premature to state what the cause of this crash was. Now, in fact, it may be exactly as this person pronounced, but again, no official investigative body has stated anything from the factual data that's been collected that would support that particular theory.
Where does this all lead us right now? The Associated Press is leading with this. It says, mystery confusion surround the Russian plane crash in Egypt. Are we lacking answers right now?
Oh, we're certainly lacking answers because the investigation is only in the earliest stages. Fortunately, the black boxes were both recovered. They're in the preliminary stage of being analyzed. It's unclear whether or not there's useful data on there yet, but I'm sure within a few days, at least that amount of information will be presented to the public. Now, beyond that, there is quite a bit of information from the wreckage itself that has yet to be analyzed in any great detail, either by the Egyptian authorities, the Airbus authorities, or the Russian authorities. So I believe that there is ample technological prowess being brought to bear in this particular situation, from the analysis of the wreckage to the analysis of the black boxes to the analysis of all the other data associated with this flight. And I'm sure that within a few weeks' time, there will be much more clarity as to the sequence of events that ended with the airplane on the desert floor.
Todd, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, Monday said he knew of no direct evidence terrorism was to blame for this crash.
Well, given that he is the head of the organization that manages both the CIA and the NSA, and also the intelligence units of the military, I'm assuming that this person has access to the best intelligence the U.S. has to offer. Given that this event occurred over the Sinai, which has been an area of intense interest of the U.S. military and intelligence communities for several generations, I'm fairly confident that there are a number of assets that are trained in that area 24/7, and that if there were anything that were consistent with, let's say, a missile being launched or with something that is a large-scale explosion, that they might have spotted that. Now, exactly what the U.S. intelligence community has spotted isn't clear, and I don't expect them to provide any detailed explanation anytime soon. But that is a very telling statement. The U.S., although it is a partner in the investigation, the U.S. intelligence community is not one of the direct partners involved in this. And to have that high-level official say something publicly means that, in my opinion, the U.S. government is trying to get a message across to someone.
And Todd Curtis says final report and information sharing with other airlines in a bid to avoid a repeat may take up to 18 months.
Thank you, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Time for a look at what's going on the web today. And joining me with the details is my colleague, Sarah Williams. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Susan. Well, Canada's Globe and Mail reports that the first 10 bodies of last weekend's plane crash over Egypt have been identified by their families. A spokesman for the Russian Emergency Situations Ministry said 140 bodies and more than 100 body parts were sent to St. Petersburg Monday and Tuesday. Another plane is expected to bring more human remains. The report says the Metrojet crashed en route from Sharm el-Sheikh to St. Petersburg, and it killed all 224 people on board. Most of them were Russian tourists returning home. Meanwhile, Israel's Haaretz reports that Egypt's president says the Islamic State's claim of downing the plane is, quote, propaganda. Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said his country's security situation in the Sinai Peninsula is under control. Speaking to the BBC, al-Sisi said the cause of the crash may not be known for months. Bloomberg reports that the Russian airliner that crashed in Egypt suffered earlier damage. The plane's tail scraped a runway in 2001 and was repaired. It says investigators will be closely examining the plane's tail section. Well, in other news, today is National Sandwich Day, and there's a hashtag dedicated to it. There are almost 20,000 tweets on this subject so far. The famous food is named after England's Earl of Sandwich, who is credited with coming up with the idea in the 18th century. CNN reports a sandwich has grown to include regional varieties. Here in the United States, it's very popular, beginning with peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for the young and not so young. Philadelphia is known for its famous cheesesteak, New Orleans for its po' boys, and Miami for its Cuban sandwiches. There are also ethnic varieties. In California a few years ago, while reporting for VOA, I sampled a banh mi, a Vietnamese sandwich with meat and vegetables on a French baguette. I tasted it in, where else, Little Saigon in Orange County near Los Angeles. It was great. Susan?
Okay, thanks, Sarah, and happy Sandwich Day.
Absolutely.
Okay, this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
If you want to wake up and stay in a good mood all day long, a new study from researchers at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine suggests that you need to get a good night's sleep. Now, that's not necessarily a lot of sleep, but some good quality uninterrupted sleep. The researchers found that being roused from sleep several times a night puts a damper on a good mood more than having a small amount of sleep without any interruptions. Patrick Finnan, the study's lead author and an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Johns Hopkins, says that when your sleep is disrupted throughout the night, you don't have the chance to go through each of the needed various phases of sleep. Not progressing through the stages of sleep can deprive you of the needed slow-wave sleep that is necessary to making a person feel refreshed and restored. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Continue our conversation with Dr. John Dye, chief of the United States Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, Viral Immunology Branch, about Ebola. Doctor, Ebola is so infectious and deadly, you must have to be very careful in your research.
Yes, ma'am. So it's not something that we just bring someone off the streets and pull them in and throw them into a high containment suite. So I personally have gone through years of training with mentors and experts to develop my technique to be able to be safe working with these viruses and bacteria, as do all of my comrades here at USAMRID. And when we bring someone in, they really part of the team, they become part of the team, and you really have to develop a trust when you're working side by side with these individuals in a high containment suite. So training and trust are the two T's that I talk about when I talk about how we go forward working with these viruses and bacteria.
I can remember that when we first started talking about Ebola, there were so many people who were scared that this was going to go all over the world, that it was going to spread because there was no way to stop it. What is your feeling about that?
So I think we worry about viruses and bacteria becoming pandemics, spreading all over the world. This was an epidemic. It spread into multiple countries in Western Africa. Honestly, Ebola isn't really that good, if you want to put quotation marks, of a virus when it comes to what it's supposed to do, because it actually kills its host. A virus isn't actually very good, if you speak in that manner, when it actually kills the organism that it's using to spread itself. So a virus is basically genetic material encapsulated in an envelope, and it uses your or my cells within our body to produce more copies of itself. And so if it kills the person or the cells that it's using to actually spread itself, it's really not that good. So Ebola and viruses, hemorrhagic fever viruses like this, they tend to burn out rather quickly. This was a very different case in Western Africa, and we can discuss that later if you'd like. But so it's not that great a virus when it comes to that. So I wasn't concerned about it becoming a pandemic, per se, spreading all over the world. But we now live in an age with globalization and transportation, which is at an all-time high, where you have the ability to jump on a plane and be anywhere in 8 to 12 hours. And there's a latency period, or a period where the virus is ramping up production in the person or the animal that is infected, so you don't really know you're infected, and then maybe you hop on a plane, you head to London, you head to New York, head to Dallas, Texas, which is exactly what happened in the U.S., and you potentially have a possibility where you could get a spread into different countries.
And you mentioned Africa.
I did. So there's a great concern of it spreading within Africa. The reason why is because the infrastructure of the health systems in these nations in all over Africa is inferior when you compare it to the infrastructure in more developed nations, and that's just a fact. So the ability to basically understand, isolate, and quarantine patients who potentially have this is somewhat restricted in these countries, so you have a greater chance of it spreading within these countries before it's actually come into check.
Trying to stop Ebola is very noble, no matter who you work for, but why is the U.S. Army so particularly interested in this?
That's a great question. So I work for the U.S. Army Department of Defense. I'm a U.S. government employee, and the reason why the U.S. Army is interested in this is we are always concerned that we'll have to send service members and service member families into regions where this particular virus or other viruses and bacteria of this nature are present. So there's that possibility. And then actually, if you look back in history and read books, in the 1980s, it was known before the fall of the Iron Curtain that the Russians were actually weaponizing virus like this. So we have a biothreat component that we're also interested in combating in case that happened.
Thank you very much, Doctor, for taking the time to speak with us. Dr. John Dye and his research was featured on the National Geographic Channel show Breakthrough. It's a new program. Coming up on International Edition, what is Russia up to concerning the internet? And Justin Bieber may be sorry in more ways than one. Russian authorities are reportedly testing measures that they say will protect Russia's internet from foreign interference. But some worry the efforts are really aimed at finding ways to cut that nation off from the web during times of political crisis. My colleague and social media expert, Doug Bernard, has joined me, and he's been following this story and He's written an article about it on our internet website, if you want to go see it. It's called Russia Possibly Testing Internet Kill Switch. And Doug, what can you tell us about this?
This, I think, is a story of a case of a public official maybe saying something to the media that he regretted later. Last week, the head of the Russian telecommunications ministry, a man named Nikolai Nikiforov, basically told Russian media that Russia was concerned that Western nations, who may be hostile to Russia's interests, may try to cut Russia off from the internet, and that Russia, much of the internet traffic in and around Russia is actually flows through hubs in Europe. So he basically said that he was ordering telecommunications and ISPs, internet service providers, to begin experimenting with various means of how Russia might, in effect, cut itself off from the internet, the global internet, but still keep its national intranet running.
Oh, kind of like an office building here.
That's exactly right.
How would this all work?
Well, that's the serious question, and that's why they were beginning testing. Now, Mr. Nikiforov came out and was talking about various means they could use without getting too technical, techniques such as maybe deep packet inspection, some other means of sort of, you know, limiting or cutting off international web traffic. But in the end, Mr. Nikiforov and the state telecommunications head basically came out and said, no, we're actually not trying this. This was a rumor. We're not thinking about this at all. I think what may have really happened, and some of the analysts that we spoke with, is that, yes, in fact, they've been testing this maybe for a while now. And what they're finding is it's very difficult to simply cut an entire nation the size of Russia off from the global internet. So now that it looks like they can't do it, it sounds like they're trying to back off and say, well, that was never our intention anyway.
Well, the thing about all this is, say they were able to cut themselves off.
Mm-hmm.
You cut yourself off from people coming through the internet into your country,
sure.
But you also prevent people from inside the country reaching out to the outside world.
Exactly. You may remember some years ago when Egypt was in the early stages of a political crisis there in the early days of the Arab Spring, and Egyptian authorities did exactly that. They kind of employed this trick to essentially erase Egypt from the internet. And they thought, well, this way we'll kind of tamp down the protests and social media outrage. What they found is that one action crippled their economy and their ability for anybody in that nation to get anything done. So clearly, I think it's just not a winning strategy, unless you're a nation like North Korea, to think that you can just cut yourself off from the global internet and keep everything functioning within your country.
But a small country might be able to do something like this.
Well, small countries possibly, because small countries have fewer access points in and out. So, for example, you look at a country like North Korea, there's a sizable population there, but there's only one access hub, in effect, where global internet traffic can go in and come out. And, of course, the North Korean officials control that hub, so they monitor everything that's coming in and out. But a nation like Russia or Egypt or for heaven's sakes, China or these other places, there's so much traffic coming in from so many places that you really just can't catch it all.
Well, thank you, Doug.
You bet.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Even domestic animals can become endangered, like the Von cat, for example. This rare breed has been brought back from near extinction by the Von Cats Research Center in Turkey. This white cat was a popular pet throughout the city of Van for centuries, but by 1992, researchers could only locate about a dozen. Dr. Abdullah Kaya is head of the Van Cats Research Center.
Since then, we have been breeding them. Right now, there are nearly 210 cats in here.
What makes this cat so unique is its oddly colored eyes, one amber and one blue. Researchers say the odds of other animals having different colored eyes is 1 in 10,000. For the Von cat, it's 16 out of 100. Here's researcher Nahid Aktash.
This is a genetic problem, but this problem makes them unique in the world.
The Von cat research center now attracts about 20,000 cat-loving tourists a year. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
Popular singer Adele has shattered a record with her long-awaited song Hello, becoming the first track downloaded more than a million times in a week in the U.S. And if you listen to us regularly, you know that Larry London with Border Crossings was talking to us just recently about Hello and what a big hit it was going to be. And Larry joins us right now. And Larry, you were right.
I predicted it. I predicted it. There it is.
You were right.
And just hot on the heels of Adele's song Hello, we've got Justin Bieber's brand new song off of his fourth album, which is called Purpose, that goes on sale November 13th. And the new song is called Sorry. And that's at number two right now, just behind Adele.
Is it too late now to say sorry? I'm missing more than just your body. Oh, is it too late now to say sorry? Yeah, I know that I let you down. Is it too late to say sorry now? Ooh, I'm sorry.
Well, Adele's standing in his way.
Yes, she is, and deservedly so. I mean, we've been waiting a number of years for both albums to come out, and he has chosen November 13th to release Purpose, which is the same date that One Direction will be releasing their brand new album, so it's an interesting story. Justin was discovered on YouTube by Usher in 2009.
No, I didn't know that.
Yes, and he was signed by Scooter Braun and has released, as I say, three albums. His fourth is coming up. He's 21. He's been written about so much in the news about his relationship with Selena Gomez and their on and off love, which is now off.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. People are wondering, is the song Sorry actually written for Selena Gomez? Because if you watch the music video, Selena's Latina, the music video features all Latinas who are dancing and singing Sorry.
Well, it does sound like it might have some merit.
It might have something to do with that. Now, Justin is known to his fans, who are called Beliebers, as a bad boy for all the trouble he's gotten into over the years. And this last year, he was on the Comedy Central roast where he promised he'd be better, he'd improve, he'd clean up his act. Well, he's not doing himself any favors.
I thought he was maturing.
He is maturing, but not fast enough, apparently. In the last week, he performed to promote his new album in Oslo, Norway. During the show, he was drinking out of a water bottle. He gave some fans the water bottle and spilled some on the stage, so he stopped after one song to clean up the mess.
Mm-hmm.
The fans wouldn't let him clean up the mess. It was right at the front of the stage. They were grabbing at him, tugging on him, taking photos. He said, stop. They kept doing it. He said, that's enough. He threw the microphone down and stormed off stage.
Whoa.
And then 2 days later, performing in Madrid, same kind of purpose. Get the purpose. That's the record name. Mm-hmm. He was on promoting the new album, and apparently he got agitated with the fans' lack of beat, being able to keep the beat. He stopped the song and said, please, at least clap to the correct beat. So he's been kind of a little testy these days.
Well, these people, the first concert with the water, did they get their money back?
I don't really know. Mm-hmm. Haven't heard one way or another. I know they were very disappointed. That much I do know. And yeah. I don't know if they're paying for these concerts or not, or if this is just a promotional type thing where you show up and get to see him sing. And probably he isn't going to do many songs. It's not a full 90-minute concert. He probably came there with the intention of doing 3 or 4 songs from the new album, but they only got one, and he left unhappy, and they were unhappy. And then later on, he put on Instagram that he was sorry, and he regretted it.
Sorry, huh?
He said, sorry. And he said, he's having a bad week, is how he framed it. So.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Larry, for stopping by.
Absolutely, Susan. Enjoy the song, and sorry.
Sorry. It's time to close the show, but we'd like to invite you to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. And if you want to listen to this broadcast or any previous one, just visit our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Everyone wins when girls go to school. For every year of education a girl attains, her future earning potential goes up by 10 to 20%. And because she is likely to share up to 90% of her earnings with her family and her community, everyone around her will benefit. Her children will be more than twice as likely to survive past the age of 5, and they will be healthier and more likely to go to school than will the children of her less literate sisters. Ultimately, educated girls grow into productive women who contribute to their country's economies and help pull others out of poverty. Nonetheless, over 62 million girls around the world are not in school, and millions more are fighting to stay there. Thus, to increase education opportunities for girls, the United States government introduced Let Girls Learn, a program through which a number of U.S. government agencies and non-governmental organizations, including the Department of State, U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the Peace Corps, and the Millennium Challenge Corporation work together to address some of the obstacles preventing adolescent girls from attending and completing school and receiving high-quality education. Pakistan is one country where girls often find it difficult to attend school. This may be due to lack of funds, because they live too far from the nearest school, or because some within their society disapprove of education for girls, especially once they reach adolescence. That is why the First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama, and First Daughter of Pakistan, Mariam Sharif, launched the Let Girls Learn initiative in Pakistan on October 22, 2015, at the White House. This initiative will provide $70 million for new and existing education programs that will help educate 200,000 Pakistani girls between the ages of 10 and 19. Educated girls become women who strengthen their families, communities, and countries, said USAID Acting Administrator Alfonso Lenhart. By increasing access to educational opportunities during the critical time of adolescence, this important initiative will be transformative for Pakistan, empowering young women to overcome barriers and lift themselves out of poverty. We look forward to continuing to work with the government of Pakistan and our partners around the world to ensure girls everywhere get the education they deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Lenore Moudou, and welcome to Health Chat. The World Health Organization is responding to multiple cholera outbreaks that could flare up and threaten the health of more people if control measures are not intensified. More than 10,700 cholera cases and almost 200 deaths have been reported in five countries in the Eastern Mediterranean and African regions: Iraq, Bahrain, Kuwait, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Tanzania. We will discuss the cholera crisis on today's program. And to do that, we are joined, in a second, we will be joined by our guest. First, from Olympia, Washington, is David Albert. David is board chairman of Friendly Water for the World, an organization working to expand global access to low-cost clean water technologies and information about health and sanitation. And in a moment, we will welcome Mr. David Albert. Also, our guest today will be Dr. Martin Mengel. Before we go to Dr. Mengel, let's welcome Mr. Albert. David Albert, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you with us. And in a moment, we will be joined by two more guests. One is Dr. Martin Mengel, and Dr. Mengel will be joining us from Paris, France. He's program leader of enteric diseases with Agence de Médecine Préventive and project director of the African Cholera Surveillance Network, AFRICOL.
And
we will have Dr. Mengel, are you there? No, he's not there yet. And another guest will be a third guest will be joining us from the Democratic Republic of Congo and share what is happening on the ground there, given that the issue is very much present there.
Who's from Congo? Say that again.
That's Dr. Jean-Luc Kambale Musubao.
Medical officer
who will be joining us, and he is with Friendly Water for the World as well.
Correct.
So we hope to have both of the gentlemen join us very soon. Before we do that, Mr. Albert, let me come to you, but in just a second, let me welcome Dr. Martin Mengel. Dr. Mengel, again, is program leader of enteric diseases and project director of the African Cholera Surveillance Network, AFRICOL. Dr. Mengel, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Linda. Thank you for having me on the show.
Fantastic. And on the line also is Mr. David Albert with Friendly Water for the World. So, gentlemen, thank you again. In a moment, we will have Dr. Musubao to join us from DRC. We hope to have him soon. So let me start by getting a picture of what is happening. First, let me start with you, Mr. Albert. You are working on the ground, as well as Dr. Mengel, AFRICOL as well, is working on the ground. But Mr. Albert, can you give us a sense of what is happening where your organization is working?
So we work in 12 different countries. Our main work, we do several different kinds of work. Our main work related to cholera is in teaching communities to build what are called biosand water filters. It's a very simple technology made of all local materials that can wipe out up to 99% of bacteria and viruses from the local water supply.
Okay.
There are cholera outbreaks in, we know of, at least five countries, the worst by far in northeast Congo.
Okay. All right. Very well. And Dr. Mengel, AFRICOL is very much present on the continent as well. What can you tell us in terms of the extent of the problem?
Globally, Linda, we have about 3 to 5 million cases of cholera estimated every year, and about 100,000 deaths, or likely much more than that. And specifically for Africa, you have to keep in mind that before the large outbreak occurred in Haiti, 98-99% of the deaths occurred in Africa, and about 80-90% of the cases. And as the cases slowly decrease in Haiti, the caseload and the case burden in Africa becomes ever more important. And there are way over 20 countries each year that notify cholera to WHO in sub-Saharan Africa.
Okay. And WHO is raising the alarm as to, what needs to be done. What can you tell us in terms of, because you are also involved, you also work with WHO. What is the if we're looking at globally, in terms of priorities, where is WHO really, what is WHO prioritizing at this stage? Is it a specific region, or is it more treatment or prevention? What is your take on this?
Well, WHO has a global mandate. There is now a global task force for cholera control at WHO headquarters in Geneva, and I mean they are really looking at this problem at a global scale through their five regional organizations that they have. And so they are equally looking for sure at the great situation that I just described from Africa. They're also looking at Haiti, also at Southeast Asia, namely Bangladesh and India, where cholera has been, which is kind of the cradle of cholera, if you so will, where cholera has been known for several thousands of years. So they're really trying to do all of this, and they're trying to look at an integrated strategy for prevention of cholera, so by providing safe water and sanitation, but also a new vaccine that is now available, and also to control cholera outbreaks where they occur, and there is a long list of those at the moment.
Okay. And Mr. Albert, when you look at the DRC, as you mentioned, is one of the most affected, if not the most affected in the region, what can you tell us in terms of the main reason? I know we hear it's a lack of clean water and sanitation, but why is it so widespread in DRC?
Well, in particular in the DRC, the population of Goma in particular, there's now a million people in Goma, and varies from time to time, but as many as 600,000 people in a very small space. So cholera will spread through the population very quickly when there is lack of decent sanitation and lack of good water, as well as limited availability of health care. And so the compacted population is what spreads the disease more quickly through the city and through the refugee camps.
Okay. Now, I have a question from Amy, because we do take live questions from our listeners, whether on Facebook or phone calls. And Amy is asking, and presently she's in Cameroon, she says, the rainy season seems to be a threat to cholera outbreaks in several countries, especially in Africa. Considering the rainy season is set to occur naturally every year, how can countries be better prepared to face recurring outbreaks of cholera? This is such an interesting and basic question. And perhaps, Dr. Mengel, I can throw this question to you. How can countries be better prepared to face recurring outbreaks, given that rainy season seems to be a threat for cholera outbreaks?
Yes, indeed, and my colleagues just mentioned the example of Goma. Cholera is a waterborne disease, so really what we need, or what people need, is safe water. They need water which has no Vibrio cholerae, which is the bacteria that causes the cholera syndrome. And what eventually is needed is that worldwide, everyone will need to have access to safe water through a piped water system, as ideally as we have it in the industrialized countries. And in the meantime, making drinking water safe through, for example, chlorination, filtering, etc., are short-term solutions that can greatly decrease the risk of getting cholera. So that's really the mainstay of cholera prevention. And for this, really the public health system in each of the affected countries needs to organize, and partners like NGOs, WHO, and international agencies can help in this battle. But in the long term, cholera needs to be fought in each country and by solidifying and consolidating the public infrastructure.
Okay.
I agree with Dr. Mango, but I would also note that in many countries, cholera is spread by piped water. That is, the lack of proper filtration and proper chlorination and cleaning of water means that when cholera is in the public water system, it spreads much, much more quickly.
Okay. And Mr. Albert, when you look at the approach in terms of addressing this issue through your organization, what is your model?
Well, our model is based on the fact that there probably is not enough money from WHO or from the entire world for governments and large entities to provide for clean water, especially in very rural areas, very quickly. We think we can provide the skills and tools for people to do it themselves with all local materials to build small businesses and cooperatives to build the kinds of interventions that can prevent cholera permanently. In Goma, for example, Dr. Kambali was not yet on the line, had gone into 26 orphanages. There are 26 orphanages in Goma, 3,800 kids, and he counted more than 700 cases of cholera, 67 deaths since January. He went in, had a team build biosand filters for each of the orphanages, and on September 2nd, we were able to certify that there was not one case of cholera in any orphanage in the city of Goma. The total cost was $1,980.
Okay. All right.
So if we could expand this, you know, massively while the world waits for a decent public water system.
Okay. Dr. Mengel, did you want to react?
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic endeavor that Friendly Waters has undertaken. And the variety of actors, I think, in the field that work on water and sanitation, I think, probably have done a lot, probably more than we can even imagine to actually keep the numbers and not have them even higher than they are. Mm-hmm. So I think such efforts are needed in the short term, and to buy time for countries to improve their public water systems. And on top of that, I've mentioned briefly that there is a vaccine available. So in places that are at imminent risk and where even short-term solutions are unlikely to be provided or to reach the populations at risk in due time, WHO recommends the integration of cholera vaccine as an additional preventive measure, so that even if people drink unsafe water, at least they don't get cholera because they are vaccinated.
And let me just mention that we are not able to reach Dr. Musubao. We'll continue, but when we do, we'll let you know. In the meantime, Dr. Mengel, let me come back to you. You spoke about the vaccine. How accessible is this vaccine? Is it something that is offered to children at a certain age as part of the vaccination program? Or can you tell us a little more about this vaccine?
Yes. Well, this vaccine requires two doses. So you need a first one and then at least 2 weeks later a second one to have the full immunity. There is currently a stockpile, a reserve that WHO manages and has a capacity of 2 million doses, although there are currently doses that are being dispensed and filled up again. So there's a varying number of vaccine in that stockpile. But countries, not individuals, have to apply for this. As I noted, there are several areas that have big problems at the moment in the world that we know, the Middle East, Africa, Central Africa, East and Southeast Africa, several countries there. So there are always, Haiti for sure, several requests from countries in parallel, and the current supply is not sufficient for all of these countries. Now, the international community, led by WHO and big donor organizations, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, UNICEF, Doctors Without Borders, AMP, are all working together to try to increase the supply of this vaccine to make it more available, more quickly available in times of crises. And I'm pretty confident that over the next few years we will see more of this available so that we can work together with the colleagues that provide safe water to provide, let's say, the best possible protection, at least in the short term, for populations that are extremely vulnerable and extremely at risk, at extreme high risk of suffering from cholera outbreaks.
Okay.
I agree with Dr. Mangal. I would note that many of the places where we work, in East and Central Africa in particular, there are no doctors, there are no nurses, there is no public health infrastructure, and sometimes there aren't even roads. So it would be wonderful to get cholera vaccine to where it's most needed, but the money won't answer that question.
So there is this comment that we hear often, and someone has sent this question anonymously. It says, is cholera a disease of the poor? Is it something perhaps that you are suggesting, Mr. Albert?
No. Cholera is an equal opportunity, deadly disease.
Okay.
However, sometimes wealthier people have better access or able to purchase clean water or using reverse osmosis systems or other ways to clean their water. But the bacteria itself, simply where there's poor sanitation, poor hygiene, and lack of clean water, you'll see cholera everywhere. It's interesting. We do some work in India, and we find that when there is a cholera outbreak, or a typhoid outbreak for that matter, you'll find it almost equally spread among populations.
Okay. Now, Dr. Mangal, you spoke about the vaccine. Who should get vaccinated in an ideal world?
In an ideal world?
Yes.
Well, maybe I can cheekily reply to that. In an ideal world, everyone would have safe water, so you wouldn't need any vaccine.
Okay.
But as it is now, let's say we'd have an unlimited supply, then there are models that classify populations at high risk, including slum dwellers, people without improved water sources and without access to sanitation, to surely above 50 million people in sub-Saharan Africa, and sure, at least an equally high number in Southeast Asia, although I don't have the exact numbers for that. So anyone without reliable access to improved water, drinking water sources, and sanitation would need to get vaccinated to have an immediate protection to buy some time to improve the water supply.
Okay. Now we have questions from our listeners, and they're very type of basic questions in terms of prevention, addressing cholera and everything. And one of the questions here from Paul, he says, what are the risks for a pregnant woman who has cholera for herself and the baby? Dr. Mangal, is it something you could answer?
Yes, well, what we know from studies is that pregnant women have an increased risk of dying themselves and of having miscarriages, so of losing the fetus. So it's mm-hmm. either or obviously both that are extremely more likely if a pregnant woman gets cholera.
Okay. And Mr. Albert, given your experience working with communities where there is no access to road, perhaps you could answer this question. Lady Christelle wants to know. She says, in a place where there is no clean water What can people do at home to prevent a cholera to spread?
Well, the main thing is focusing on sanitation, the proper use of latrines, hand washing will actually wipe out quite a bit of the spread. The next step is trying to find access to clean water. We particularly like to use biosand filters because they can be built locally by people themselves, and we can train them to do that. We actually work in several Batwa pygmy communities where we have basically changed the situation from where there was a child death every three days to fewer than one every 6 months. This can be done, in fact, at the local level. People attempt to boil water in some places. However, sometimes they don't boil it long enough, and the result is not particularly good. Chlorine can kill cholera as well, but you have to use it religiously every time, and we find that very difficult for people in many situations. They actually don't even have access to it in many places.
Okay. And Dr. Mengel, what are the signs of cholera, someone developing cholera? The question here is, we know about diarrhea at some point. How do we make a difference between cholera-related diarrhea and any other diarrheal disease, for example?
Yes, so cholera usually starts about 6 to 12 hours after having taken up the bacteria, and one should note a significantly large number of the bacteria. So usually water has to be quite highly contaminated for it to cause the cholera, full-blown cholera disease. That just on top of the earlier remarks on the prevention of my colleague. It usually starts with nausea, headaches, general generally feeling bad, and then very violent and very abundant diarrhea starts, and that is usually quite characteristic. The classical syndrome talks about rice water diarrhea, which is really just almost pure water with a few kind of grains of solid material from the intestine, and so that's quite characteristic. So cholera causes a worse, let's say a very, very violent diarrhea, worse than what you would expect in your usual kind of like diarrhea caused by a virus, like norovirus or something like that. And there's usually vomiting, and then due to the dehydration, to the loss of body fluid through the diarrhea, the patient gets cramps, weakness, falls unconscious, falls into coma, and eventually dies. And that can happen quickly, within a few hours only, 6-7 hours sometimes, if not treated. So diarrhea is one of the few diseases probably that can take a completely healthy adult from complete health to death within just a few hours. Few diseases can actually do that in that short time. The good news is it's very easy to treat cholera. All you really need to do is replace the fluid that is lost. Mm-hmm. So either by drinking oral rehydration fluid, which is basically water mixed with a certain concentration of salts, and this comes ready-made in little bags that you can mix at home. And in cholera, during cholera outbreaks, there are stations, little health posts that distribute this kind of solution. So with proper treatment and proper access to treatment, no one has to die of cholera. Mm-hmm. And even in such a huge outbreak as in Haiti, the cholera death rate is way below 1%. I think it's about 0.5% or so of the overall since 2010 that patients have died. And that just shows you the good treatment that's actually available. And if the drinking is not longer possible, you can replace fluids directly into the vein. With special rehydration solutions that are infused into the patient in a health post or in a hospital or in a cholera treatment center.
Okay.
So to back up what he said. I wish Dr. Musabal was here because he witnessed many of the cholera deaths in the orphanages where the death rate was almost 10%. And again, these deaths could have been prevented with both prevented or treated if there were proper access to treatment, but they could neither afford meds nor hospitalizations. And when the kids died, they couldn't even afford coffins. So, and this is in the city where there is a significant public health infrastructure, several hospitals, many NGOs located, government sources, and still the death rate was almost 10%. I wanted to follow up on a comment which actually goes back to the previous question and Dr. Mango's excellent summary. You need a fairly high concentration of Vibrio cholera in order to usually contract the disease. And what happens, cholera usually is concentrated in the water before the rains come. That is, when the water sources begin to dry up or the number, the concentration of cholera goes up. Then when the rains come, that cholera gets spread much, much more widely. So it's not just a matter of rainfall. Actually, typhoid is, I usually think of, is the disease most associated with rainfall. But rather, the drought followed by rainfall is usually when you see cholera spreading more rapidly.
Okay. Now, Dr. Mangold, tell us about AFRICOL's work in terms of addressing this. When we look at sometimes the way it's spread, sometimes it seems to go regional. Is there a need for better collaboration between health authorities in neighboring countries? And how is AFRICOL addressing this issue?
Yes, I would absolutely say that there is a need. And again, I think Goma is a prime example of this. Goma is a large city where around a million people, right on the border of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda. And so so are many other places located basically on border crossings. And cholera definitely does not respect national boundaries. So the collaboration between neighboring countries such as the Congo, DRC, Rwanda, and Uganda, which also has a border with DRC along lakesides, or if we look at a coastal environment such as the West African coast, Ghana, Togo, all the way down, actually, to Nigeria or further up north and to Guinea. All of those countries have suffered large outbreaks, and they are often correlated in time. So those countries really would benefit from closely working together. And in Africa, we're very lucky to have a network of countries that work using a standard methodology for cholera surveillance. So basically, notifying at each case and at the place where this case occurred and what time and what date the symptoms started, and then confirming the Vibrio cholera in the laboratory from the stools of that patient. And this allows us to compare the epidemiology of cholera between the different countries and exactly to pinpoint which are places at increased risk. Yep. Because although we've heard from Friendly Waters how, let's say, simple the tools can be that can have a huge impact, getting them to the people seems to be a big
challenge.
Problem.
Yes, and we have to leave it there, unfortunately. Dr. Mangold, thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Mangold with AFRICOL. Mr. Albert with Friendly Water for the World, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us.
Gentlemen. And I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, D.C. with producer Jackson Vunganyi. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
Thank you, Lenore. Bye-bye.